Welcome to Supernatural Podcast, episode number 39 for Folsom Prison Blues and what is and what should never be. Let's start with Folsom Prison Blues. It originally aired in the U.S. on April 26, 2007. The title of the episode is from a song of the same title by Johnny Cash. The song is about being in Folsom Prison and wanting to get out and catch the nearby train to somewhere far away. This is the second Cash reference this season, the other one in Crossroad Blues. In fact, it's the second time blues was used as the title of an episode. So let's jump into the recap. It's from wikipedia.org. The episode was written by John Scheiben and directed by Mike Roll. After being deliberately arrested for breaking and entering a museum, the brothers meet FBI agent Hendrickson, who wants to charge them with murder. The hunters have only a week to find the ghost of the county jail while awaiting extradition to other states. In solitary confinement after an altercation with another prisoner, Dean witnesses the typical eerie signatures of a haunting and hears the blood-curdling screams of an inmate in the next cell as he is being killed. All clues point to a convict who died after being brutally beaten by prison guards 30 years ago. While Dean creates a diversion by taunting another inmate, Sam steals away to the dead convict's cell and burns his blood-stained mattress. Dean's antics land him and his adversary in the infirmary, where the older Winchester is attacked by the spirit of a nurse. He escapes by throwing salt from his meal tray at her, but the other inmate is killed. Sam and Dean find out that the ghoulish nurse was probably a vigilante who murdered inmates, but who was herself killed during a prisoner uprising. The brothers escape from jail with the help of the fatherly deacon, who turns out to be a prison guard. With Hendrickson hot on their trail, they track down the fiend's grave using information provided by the female public defender. As the two hunters watch the nurse's remains go up in flames, Hendrickson and his team find themselves at the wrong cemetery, having been intentionally misled by the lawyer. The Winchester brothers and their Impala drive away deep into hiding. Let's move on to discussion with Josh. Hi, this is Ellen.
And this is Josh.
All right, now let's talk about Folsom Prison Blues. What'd you think?
Overall, I thought it was a good, creepy episode. It was a good standalone, as we've seen a lot of in the past, but it was one that I thought that both, you know, fans and newcomers alike could enjoy.
I agree. I really liked it. I didn't think I would like it as much as I ended up liking it, if that makes sense.
I do. It does make sense.
It got back to one of the subplot arcs, which right. I really liked. I'm glad they brought that up. I knew we'd see him again, but I didn't know when we'd see Agent Hendrickson again. It was sort of predictable, but not too predictable.
It was an obvious, you know, setup to put them in a new type of situation. I think they did it well, at least made it really enjoyable to watch.
And I liked how it didn't tie up all nice and neat, that they're actually in more trouble than they had started off to be.
Yep, just keep digging themselves in further and further.
That's right. The writing was fantastic. I loved the one-liners that they gave Dean. He was back in full glory.
Oh yeah, yes, he definitely got all the best lines.
From the mugshot right on through, so that was great.
That's right. The mugshot, which some people have said was a little bit adjusted considering the height in the back.
Yes, that definitely was not right, because Jensen's 6'1 and or 6'2, depending on, I guess, who you talk to.
Right.
And it said he was 6'3.
And maybe it's the boots.
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, just like they did with John Wayne, they want to make them all appear larger than they really are, even though in Jared's case, that's really not necessary.
Making him 6'5 or 6'6.
Yeah. He's a giant.
But I agree. I enjoyed the humor. There was a lot of that in the episode. And there was also a lot of creepiness with the bad guy and the, you know, murders that were implied. So I enjoyed that as well.
Yes. And I like that it wasn't quite your standard ghost haunting it. They were on the wrong track and then they had to change their game plan. So it kept you on your toes a little bit.
Yep. Had the fake out with the murderer and ended up being crazy nurse lady.
Yep. And I love Tiny, the inmate. I read a great post about how they must have sent out casting calls saying, "We want to find the largest person you can possibly find. Make right. him about the height and weight of a Clydesdale horse."
No kidding. Someone who will look large next to Jared.
Yep. Somebody that can freak him out. Although in new situations, it doesn't seem to be all that difficult.
Yes, it was fun to watch. You know, Dean adjust to life in prison as well as he did his life as a PA, with Sam freaking out on both counts.
He just trusts Dean so blindly, he'll go to jail for him. And I liked how at the beginning of the episode, they when they were caught at the Anthropology Museum, well, one, they had gloves on, which is the first time we've ever seen that. But
the one time they're actually caught.
Yeah. What's up with that? But they did keep some, they made a nice touch there. Dean didn't have his ringer's amulet on because he knew he was going to get caught. That was my first tip off. I'm like, wait, he's not wearing his jewelry. Something is not right here. But then it all happened so fast when they went to jail. At first I was like, how were they so stupid not to know that? And I'm like, oh, I kind of felt stupid. I'm like, oh, they did it on purpose.
Right.
Of course, I didn't read the description of the episode before I watched it.
Yeah, that kind of gives it away.
But I like that he didn't have that stuff on, because they would have taken it and he would have come back with it and went, how did he get that back?
That's an excellent point. That's a good catch on the part of the writers as well as you as a viewer.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, the fact that they managed to, quote unquote, escape anyhow with Deacon's help, he couldn't have gotten their personal belongings and given them to him. That would have been really weird.
Right.
So right. At least they explained that all properly.
That is good. It was good, you know, like you mentioned before, that Agent Hendrickson made another appearance and is still on their tail. And I liked how their public defender brought up some of the weirdness that is involved in their case and in their file, because that's something that you're bound to notice when investigating them.
They all have their standard, you know, grave desecration and robbery, right, and forgery and all these other wonderful crimes that they're committing, but they could be explained so many different ways. And the FBI agent will only look one direction.
Right. And those are the crimes they actually did commit, you know, for a reason, of course.
Yeah.
But the other ones, the bigger ones, the murders, are the ones that are seriously questionable when you ask about the witnesses and everything.
Exactly. So I think there's more than meets the eye with Agent Hendrickson.
Exactly. It seems to look that way.
I just don't know that we'll find out anything this season about it. He seems kind of pop up a couple times, but it's not a huge focus.
Yeah, you're right. It doesn't seem like he's been a major bad guy yet.
So unless he's playing some other role...
Right.
I just don't think we'll see him again this season. I think there are too many other things going on.
Was there anything else you liked?
The acting was amazing on Jensen's part. It was great. Sure, he does have a lot of talent and most people, but the CW is actually campaigning for him to have an Emmy nomination.
For real?
The only CW actor to be on the long list of potential nominations.
Oh, wow.
Of any category, of any show, and it's for his work with the finale.
Really?
Yep, because they always, you're only nominated for an individual episode, never right. For an entire show or season. It's always for an individual episode, and his is for the finale.
Wow, that's interesting. I always thought, you know, Lauren Graham or somebody would get nominated eventually.
She does pop up every once in a while. I was really impressed. I mean, and of course, we're pretty far from Emmy nominations yet, so who knows, others will pop up, but Jensen's right up there, so.
Oh, well, I think it's well-deserved.
I think so, too. His acting in this episode, particularly, I liked a lot.
Yes, he does a great job of playing the serious roles as well as the comedic ones.
As far as what I did not like, there seemed to be a lack of realism. I mean, even in the world of Supernatural, this episode seemed a little unrealistic.
Yep, I have to agree with you there. The whole concept is a little risky on thinking you can break into a prison and break out so easily.
It's like, why would you do that? Why would you risk it when you're wanted and you're on the FBI's list?
Right.
It seemed a little strange.
Yes, and they did seem a little surprised when he showed up, like that wasn't part of the plan, but I don't see how you couldn't, you know, think of that as a possibility.
Sam kept saying, are you sure this is going to work? Are you sure?
Which is what the audience is thinking, too.
But the first tip-off was that, well, really the first scene we saw, was that the guard was telling the prisoner to turn off his lights in his cell.
Right.
That's
right.
Not at all real. When do prisoners have access to their own lights?
That's right. It's generally taken care of for them.
I mean, that could be something that could be used as a weapon.
Right.
The other thing that really bothered me was the ghost kill pattern. It doesn't make any sense. Over the course of the 3 days, two or three days, whatever, that the Winchesters are there, it tries to kill three people. So it kills about once a day. But if you look at the prison over the 3 months before the boys arrive, it would mean it killed roughly 90 people, and there's no mention of a number of deaths. We assume it's just a couple.
Right.
So why would it suddenly escalate the murder rate when the boys arrive?
Because it's convenient for the plot.
Well, I know, but I was like, stop that.
Yep, you're absolutely right. You think that would garner some kind of a national attention if that many prisoners die in that short period of time.
Yeah, I mean, didn't they, I didn't look it up again, but wasn't it like a long time in between the deaths? Like this has been going on for like 40 years or something, but it's only once in a while?
Well, you know, the whole releasing of the spirit from that era, you know, from that area that had been sealed off.
Yeah, that's true.
Supposedly triggered the whole thing, but they didn't get right in, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know that it's upping the suspense with having her kill so frequently while they're around, but...
Yes, that's true. I mean, there was good suspense. And I did like the nurse, although she moved like Bloody Mary, and she did
right.
The whole heart attack thing that we've seen before. I mean, she was not a new baddie at all. She was just a recycle of other characters. But she looked good, and I thought it was very suspenseful.
Right. Yeah, you're right. It was another vengeful spirit type bad guy, which is like their standby if we need some kind of mystery episode but don't want to come up with a new legend or theme, then it's the old vengeful spirit. Right. We just had one of those on the road. Now it's in a prison, so that's what makes it different. Well, it's interesting that Deacon was in this episode, an old friend of John's. I think that, as we just recently discussed, that John's influence is kind of waning on their lives after his death, and they're not using the notebook as much, but then all of a sudden Deacon pops up, which shows that, you know, John's past is still influencing their lives in some way.
That is true. That was nice. But we don't know anything about him. I mean, we know
no.
He was in the Marine Corps, but we don't know why John kept in contact with him, or if he did, and how Deacon knew what John did, unless maybe
right.
He's part of that circle. Or I was like, come on, tell me who this guy is. At least something, like a sentence about how
exactly.
He knows all of this stuff, and how he knew how to get a hold of the boys.
Yeah, it did seem like he was just out of the blue, and it's implied that John owed him some kind of debt, but it's never said what it is, or like you said, how he knew about what they could do and why they would call him to the prison.
Yeah, it seemed very strange to me, sudden, like, oh, we want to introduce a friend who, by the way, does not die. All of John's friends are dead, for the most part. Everyone we hear about, well, except Bobby, but that's because Bobby is really smart and really good
yeah,
at what he does.
Yeah, and Deacon didn't seem to be a part of the hunting thing, but he did seem to be aware of it. So that makes him different than the others that we've seen. And
but I wonder if John had other friends out there. I mean, it seemed to me, right after Mary died, he kind of went into this horrible depression, isolated himself, and then he just suddenly left. He took the boys and became this outlaw.
Right.
But did he maintain some sort of social network, except with other hunters? I mean, does
right.
He still have friends? We don't know. I mean, we really don't. I'm hoping maybe some of that will be covered in the little comic book that
right.
They're doing. That would be kind of fun. But, I mean, who is Deacon? Who are his other friends? We don't know much about his days in
no.
The Marine Corps either.
He seemed like a plot point, you know, the one reason why they would be in the prison. It would, unless he's going to play some kind of role in the future, it would have been nice to have his relationship to John and the boys explained a little bit more.
Yep, or just write him off as this is the only time you'll ever see him. He's a good friend, but he was just doing a favor because he saved his life from
exactly.
Some fire or something. I mean, just give us a little bit so we don't have to keep wondering about who this guy is and
right.
If he's going to play another role.
Exactly.
I know, it seems like there were a lot of things
right.
I didn't like, but
yes.
I really did like this episode. There were just a few things that just
That's
drove
right.
Me crazy.
We enjoy it, even if we nitpick it.
Dean was at his finest, winning
right.
All the smokes. It was so funny because he didn't want to use them then.
Right.
Sam was like, come on, let's get some information. He's like, no, they're mine.
He definitely gets deep into his roles that he plays.
It's like he's just very proud of the money he earns and the stuff he gets.
Even if it's gained dishonestly.
My other big question was, why did the nurse go after Deacon at the end?
Yes, it's a good question. I think that it could have been explained by the fact she whispered to him, you let them go. So apparently that made him a bad man. because he let criminals go. But you have to wonder, you know, what's her omniscience level? Is she just observing what she sees at the prison, or does she know stuff about the people she attacks? Is there a reason why?
Does she have a pattern? Or, I mean, the guys that she goes after. I mean, she went after Dean, but
Right.
not Sam.
Which is something interesting that, you know, you brought up to me last week. Is it because Dean was just in the prison, just happened to be there, or is it because of something he may have done in his past?
And does it have something to do
Right.
with Bloody Mary? Were his eyes blood? Kripke promised he would tell us this season.
Yes, that was implied that he had some secret, some dark secret, which I had completely forgotten about until you mentioned it. But yes, it'd be very, you know, it might be giving the writers too much credit when we, you know, think about that, but that'd be a very neat twist if that's why the nurse attacked him.
But I liked the DA. I liked her character a lot. I like that. Like you said, she was just open and was questioning what was happening. Of course, she's a DA and it's her job to do that kind of thing, but she seemed really personable, not just somebody who was assigned to the job. Like, she really cared about them. She really wanted to
Right.
help them.
Yes, and I think that, you know, as unrealistic as that may seem, they do such a good job. It has a lot to do with the actors doing a good job of being people that can charm others and influence their behavior just based on the things they say and do, because she's a total stranger. Why should she help them at all, you know, give them the benefit of doubt at all? But
That's
they
right.
somehow managed to charm all of these people into helping them. And I think it's believable because they write it that way and because, you know, the actors sell it so well.
She didn't know them. I mean, she'd only just met them, and yet she believed what Dean was saying enough for her to go look
Right.
into it and help him. That idea alone would seem very convoluted,
Right.
very weird, but it didn't. It came across totally
Exactly.
normal.
And maybe it's because we know the characters and we automatically trust them, you know?
I mean, even the people that they know, like Joe and those guys, they didn't really trust him either because of, well, of course, because of his
Right.
dad. But I mean, they seemed a little standoffish, and they actually had something in common with them.
It's true. It's true. Even dead ghost lady didn't want to believe him after they saved her and everything.
But I love the DA, how she smiled
Yes.
at the end. She knew she was going to screw the FBI. Maybe she got turned down for a job
I
and she's bitter or
would have been
something.
bitter too, the way
But
he talked to her in that scene and, you know, made her feel like her ideas and perspectives on the case were unimportant.
And I'm not even her. I'm like, how dare you
Exactly,
talk
which
to her like
helps,
that?
you know, that lends credence to the idea that she would want to get him in the end.
But yeah, I think it was good to see Hendrickson again and not some other FBI agent. And Dean was surprised that they showed up that fast. Well, they're tracking them. If they're
Right.
going to show up arrested in a jail, of course they're going to know. It's going to come up.
Especially with that psycho speech he gave him on the phone at the bank, where he made it sound like he was going to do everything in his power to get them. And
And I like how they described how hard it was to find them. So it really does explain where they've been, you know, why he hasn't found them for 6 months or whatever it is.
right, whatever it is in supernatural time.
Yeah, they don't give us many timelines. It's last season they were pretty good with it, but this season, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? They probably avoid that because all that driving they have to do, they wouldn't want us comparing, like, well, it takes 3 days to drive here. And
It's like, yes, the Impala can fly. Just get over it.
that's right.
This episode was very enjoyable, very straightforward. There were really not many surprises, or, you know, we didn't learn a lot in this one, except that, you know, nurses like to kill people in prison.
Right. And John's got some random friends out there, apparently.
Which I swear I've seen that actor before, but I can't place him.
I think he's one of those that's, you know, always in the background or always been in a bunch of shows.
Probably. They like to have those guys around.
Right.
Unless they're another CW actor. Oh, the quotes were so good.
They
What was
were.
your favorite?
My favorite was probably when Dean was being mean to Tiny and he told him that they're just donuts, not love.
That was hilarious. My favorite one was when Sam and Randall were mopping the floor, and Randall asked him, "Why are you inside?" And he says, "Because I got an idiot for a brother."
And Randall says that'll do it. That was my second favorite.
The interaction between Dean and Tiny was just great all around.
Right.
Tiny, his brother shot his dad with a gun and killed him. Makes me wonder if that something like that wouldn't happen if Sam and Dean and John had all been traveling together.
Oh, no kidding. He seems to miss that parallel with his own life.
Okay, let's move on to legends and references. As far as legends, there is a long history of ghosts haunting prisons. Immediately, I thought of Alcatraz with all of its hauntings. If you've ever been there, it's a very spooky place. Many old prisons in the U.S. have supposed hauntings, and I like the twist with the killer nurse rather than previous inmates doing the hauntings. Beyond Alcatraz, there's another haunted prison I'd like to talk about. It's the Mansfield Reformatory in Mansfield, Ohio. The Guinness Book of World Records lists this massive, medieval-looking prison built in 1896 as the world's largest freestanding steel cell block, having six tiers. Levi T. Scott, a Cleveland architect, modeled the prison after old-world German castles. He built the prison with the intentions of having a spiritual and uplifting architecture to help better rehabilitate the young men who would be brought there. For much of its existence, the Mansfield Reformatory served as a home to middle-of-the-road criminals, young men who were too old for the local boys' reformatory and not yet hardened enough to serve time in the maximum security Ohio penitentiary. The Mansfield Reformatory Preservation Society, MRPS, who now owns the deed to the prison since it closed in 1990, was founded and leased the land from the state of Ohio. Since then, Hollywood blockbuster movies like Shawshank Redemption and Air Force One have been filmed on the grounds. MRPS now conducts Hollywood tours and public ghost hunts inside the Gothic prison for a set donation to the society. Since the doors were closed on the reformatory, there have been legends that the prison is filled with restless spirits of tormented inmates, guards, and prison officials who were never able to leave. As expected with this type of prison, there are gruesome tales of pain, violence, suicides, murders, and other accidental deaths. The terrible past events trap the ghosts behind the prison stone walls and decaying iron cell bars. It has been suggested that the architecture of the prison itself focuses on paranormal energies into the prison. The tops of all the prison towers are pyramid-shaped. They each point towards the large central pyramid tower that spirals down into the heart of the reformatory. Whatever the reasons behind the prison's ghosts, it becomes clear to visitors that the hallways of the closed Mansfield Reformatory are not as empty as they appear. The administration wing of the prison was a home and office to Warden Glatke and his wife Helen. Both of them died in this section of the prison. Helen Glatke's death was controversial. She accidentally knocked a loaded .32 automatic pistol off a high closet shelf while attempting to remove a jewelry box from the shelf. The gun went off, hit the floor, and the bullet struck Helen, killing her instantly. A decade later, Warden Glatke died of a heart attack in his office. It's believed that both the ghosts of Warden Glatke and his wife Helen haunt the reformatory. At certain times, visitors can feel cold rushes of air move over their bodies. Strange anomalies are regularly recorded in the administration wing. Photographic orbs and equipment failure are common. The most infamous pink bathroom is also in the administration section. Visitors to the pink bathroom reportedly smell fresh flowers and perfume scents. In the chapel, electrical equipment mysteriously fail and shadows seem to move in the darkness. Strange photographs and EVP recordings can be taken there. There are rumors that the chapel room was used as an execution chamber years before it was turned into a chapel. Inmates were tortured and hung from the rafters, and there are reports of a spirit peeking around the doors into the room, pulling away after it is noticed. It's believed that the chapel, with all of its eerie occurrences, is a main source of the haunting. Murders and suicides occurred in the cell blocks. Inmates tied bedsheets around their necks and then twisted them around the bars until they strangled themselves to death. Other inmates were thrown off of the high tiers for something as trivial as a pack of cigarettes. Life inside a prison is hard and filled with hate, wickedness, and agony. The ghosts haunting these cell blocks are still dealing with the same emotions and hardships they struggled with every day of their life. The building has changed, but the negative feelings continue. The prison's most violent events happened in 1957 after a prison riot. An estimated 120 inmates were sentenced to 30 days in the hole. The hole was solitary confinement in a basement level of the prison equipped with only 20 cell units. The legend is that two men went into a cell and only one came out alive. The bodies of the murdered inmates were tucked away under the beds. The hole is a place that has witnessed the darkest side of human nature. The negative energies left behind make this area one of the most significant haunted hearts inside the prison. Exploring the entire Mansfield Reformatory can be physically and mentally exhausting. Witnessed events are hard to account for with reasonably logical explanations. Paranormal investigators continue traveling to this old prison searching for its hidden secrets. Mansfield Reformatory's darkest secret may be the fact that even in death, some souls do not find freedom. This article is from the Ghost Hunter's Bible by Trent Brandon. So let's move on to references. There's some great lines in this episode. One was by Dean. Great, another guy who's seen Taxi Driver one too many times. This references the 1976 movie starring Robert De Niro and Jodie Foster. A classic, great movie. There are classic prison break movies referenced, such as The Great Escape by Steve McQueen and James Garner, and Escape from Alcatraz starring Clint Eastwood, one of my personal favorites. Dean says, I call this one The Blue Steel. That was about his mugshot, and he references the 2001 film Zoolander starring Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson as male models. Blue Steel was one of Stiller's trademark faces. Dean mentions Nick Nolte as he is being photographed, referring to Nolte's infamous mugshot following his arrest in 2002. Who could forget that picture? And in joke, Sam says, innocent? And Dean replies, are you from Texas all of a sudden? It is in reference to the fact that although their characters are from Kansas, both Jared and Jensen are from Texas. There were a couple songs in this episode. One, Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs, and Rooster by Alice in Chains. Let's move on to what is and what should never be. This episode originally aired in the U.S. on May 3rd, 2007. It was directed by Eric Kripke and written by Rael Tucker. That's a winning combination. Let's jump into the recap from SuperWiki. In an abandoned warehouse in Joliet, Illinois, Dean is attacked by a djinn he is hunting. He wakes up next to a beautiful girl and wanders about an unfamiliar apartment. He calls Sam, who is studying his law books, only to find Sam thinks he's drunk. Dean discovers he's in Lawrence, Kansas, and drives to his childhood home to find his mother alive. The past has changed. There was no demon attack, no fire. John died the previous year of a stroke in his sleep. The next day, Dean revels in suburban life, spending time with his mother and mowing the lawn. Sam and Jessica arrive. They have flown in from California for Mary's birthday. That night at dinner in a restaurant, Sam and Jess announce their engagement. During the celebrations, Dean is distracted when he sees a young woman who he had glimpsed on the street earlier. At home, Dean is keen to go out and spend time with his girlfriend Carmen and Sam and Jess. Sam confronts Dean over his behavior. He and Dean are not close, and he doesn't understand Dean's friendly demeanor. Back at his apartment, Dean starts enjoying his life with Carmen. However, later that night, he sees a news broadcast that leads him to discover that all the people he remembers saving are now dead. The ghostly woman appears to him again, and Dean sees images of dead people in his closet. Distraught, Dean visits John's grave and anguishes over why it is his job to sacrifice things in order to save people. He comes to an unspoken resolution and realization and walks off. Dean is caught by Sam as he breaks into Mary's house to steal a silver knife, pretending that he needs to pay a gambling debt. Sam insists on accompanying Dean, and they drive to Illinois to the abandoned warehouse. There they find the girl that Dean has been seeing, and she's being held captive by the djinn. She appears to be hallucinating. Dean has flashes of images, and he starts to suspect that he too is being held by the djinn, and everything he has experienced is an illusion. It's all in his head. Dean decides that if he is in a dream and he kills himself, he will wake up. Sam tries to dissuade him, and then Mary, Carmen, and Jess appear, imploring him to stay and be happy. In the real world, Dean wakes up as Sam is rescuing him. The djinn attacks, but Dean kills it. They find the girl Dean keeps seeing, weak, but still alive. Back in their motel, Dean is still in pain from the life he glimpsed. Sam tries to convince him that all the people they have saved make their sacrifice worthwhile. Let's move on to analysis and discussion with Josh.
So let's talk about what is and what should never be. I have one word for this episode. Fantastic. I loved it.
Well, I have to agree. I really, really liked it. I think that it's a Dean lover's dream come true because it's all about him. And on top of that, it's really well written. And it's an episode that the fans can really love because you really have to know and care about the characters to understand how much all of the changes would affect Dean and Sam that happened in this wish world.
This is the episode that was directed by Eric Kripke.
Oh, that's correct.
Yep. It was written by Rael Tucker, who I love.
Yes.
She's one of my favorite writers. She always does the heartfelt episodes.
Right.
Like Home. I think she also did Faith and some of the others. So, of course, don't kill me if I don't have that right.
Yes, I noticed that when it started up that it was directed by Eric Kripke.
I mean, the last one was John Scheiban, who does more of the action stuff. So it worked really well for Folsom Prison Blues. But this one, I already had high expectations. I'm like, oh, it's a Kripke episode.
Right.
I mean, really, you can't screw that up.
Right.
Not when you have the creator working on it. And I think what I loved was the overall premise. You know, doesn't everyone wish that they could see what things would have been like if they'd made a different choice?
Right. And although, you know, it's not a new premise, it's been done, you know, ever since It's a Wonderful Life, but it's always different for each character in each situation, and it's neat to explore.
We have a lot of the realism coming in. Something I loved was that the Impala has a new license plate. It's an Ohio license plate. It's number CNK80Q3.
which is good since you're being hunted by the FBI.
So two things, new license plate, and if they could just carry a stock of gloves.
Right.
The date in the alternative reality was December 5th, 2006, as the TV reports that it was 1 year since Flight 424 crashed.
Oh, that's correct.
And when he looks up the crash, it happened December 5th, 2005. And so it gives us an idea of where we are.
Right.
In his time. You know, that would have been all working, and Sam would have been in law school. All of these things would have been happening. So that realism was there.
I really like that they, you know, it was another myth that they were exploring as well. As a what if episode, it was also a, you know, what about genies or the djinn? And I thought it was a very interesting interpretation of genie lore.
And I liked the way the djinn looked. Like, he had a nice look to it.
Pretty neat effects with the glowy blue stuff.
So, yeah, he looked really good. And I liked that part of it, the genie and the, you know, there's so many myths and legends, and we actually talk about it later on in the episode. But I like their interpretation. You're right. It was great. Really well done.
Yes. I mean, it's something that never crossed my mind before, the whole wish-granting thing, that the creatures themselves don't grant the wishes. They just make it appear like they have.
Yeah.
And you can see how something like that would get twisted, you know, down through time, where you think that, oh, they grant wishes, but...
Well, especially if you've seen Disney's version.
Right, exactly.
I wanted to see, where's the lamp? Okay, come on.
That's right. Right, or I dream of genie.
Yeah. He talks about that. That's funny. The idea for Sam not to know about hunting and think that Dean has lost his mind came from the original draft of the pilot. In the original script, Dean was a hunter because he had a feeling that something supernatural killed his father when he was young, and Sam had long ago estranged himself. And I like that they took that and brought it in.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
They were finally, they were able to use that idea. I think it worked really well.
It did. It worked really well with the family dynamic, the situation that Sam would find him in, that we all thought he would be in based on his reaction to Dean when he showed up in the pilot and how he had his life set, you know, and then Dean comes along and ruins everything.
And they actually recreated that scene.
Right.
At first I thought maybe they had just kind of took that... And that's what would have happened instead, you know, that would have been, that he still would have been at that place at that time doing that same thing with Sam.
Right.
But then I was like, well, wait a minute. No, that's not quite right.
Right.
But I like that they did that. It made you really tie in the pilot after all this time has passed.
I thought it was really well done that they did that. And in the whole situation, you know, being at Mary's house, I mean, I thought it was perfect that it was the return of Mary Winchester and that Dean's wish didn't save John, but her as well. Because he may have, you know, been really close with John and he'd been really obedient, but, you know, in reality, he wanted his mom back.
And John died anyway.
Right.
Which is really kind of interesting. No matter what they did, he was not destined to live.
Right. Which can lead to a lot of speculation. Yep. I also enjoyed, you know, there was still some scary aspects to the show. Although most of it was, you know, fantasy, what if, happy land, but it had the scary girl and the bodies hanging in the closet were really creepy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that girl in white
right.
keeps wandering around. You're like, who is that girl?
Which, you know, and honestly, when I saw the girl in white, I thought of the episode of Buffy where it was a kind of a what-if world where one of the minor characters wished that he was super popular and famous. And so the whole episode is based around this character, but there was a downside that this horrible monster came. In order for him to live this fantasy world, this horrible monster was killing people, or was going to kill people and stuff. So I thought that that's where they were headed with this episode, where Dean gets this perfect life, but all these people are going to die as a result.
Yeah, and there for a while, you don't know which one he's going to choose.
Right.
But... You know, and he's meant to seem very happy. You know, he has his family. All of these things are... It's his fantasy world he's living. But at the same time, when you see him in the apartment and he's drinking the beer, he seems really unhappy.
Right. Like
did you notice
a piece of
that?
His life is missing, yeah.
Yeah. So even though he was living this life that he wished he had, it didn't seem right to him.
Right. Which would be hard to make that giant shift when you feel like you have a mission in life to just give it up, even if you're... The result is that your family members are happiest and you're happiest.
I think it was probably just Jensen's acting able to pull that off and not necessarily just the writing. The way his facial expressions were and the way with his body language and his, you know, just kind of his whole persona.
Right.
It really carried that.
I agree. And I think that, you know, we commended his acting for the last episode, but I think that this one, as usual, you know, was great as well. Like, that scene at the grave, at John's grave, could have been really super cheesy, but he did a great job of selling it.
Oh, this episode killed me. I mean, to see him finally go and see John's grave, even if he knew it wasn't real, like, he knew something was not right, he had that moment that he was able to mourn.
Right.
That he was able to talk to John and kind of get those unresolved things and those feelings out that we'd seen the first two episodes of the season.
Right.
It was very cathartic for him.
Exactly. And of course, you know, in the hands of the wrong person, it would have seemed really whiny and sissy, but he did a great job with it.
And did you see he was still wearing a necklace rather than the amulet?
That's right.
So, and he still had the same kind of clothes that he was wearing. I mean, he's really the same guy, only yeah, with a whole different situation around him.
Right, still mowing the lawn in layers.
With no blade on the motor, or on the lawnmower, by the way.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which might explain why the neighbor looked at him like he was crazy.
I did like the twist at the end. I didn't really pick up on the clues, it's all in your head sort of thing. I thought maybe it was more like in Crossroads, where he was going to be given a choice.
I agree. I didn't pick up on any of that. Like I said before, I thought it was going to be, you know, some horrible effect of having this dream world, but not the fact that it wasn't even a real dream world, which is well played, you know, that I didn't see it coming.
You know, I'm so nitpicky, I can't help it. But, you know, on first glance, we see goofs. You know, what I think is that they're oops, that the writer, or that something happened along the way that they just didn't quite make all the connections.
Right.
But on second thought, I think it was actually that they're intentional. So I can't decide if this is a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know if I liked it or not. Like I'd said with the lawnmower, of course, I noticed that there were four things. What I'm thinking now is that they were intentionally put there because they were Dean's subconscious efforts to indicate to himself that something was wrong.
Oh, right.
Like his real body was telling his mind that something was not in sync. So there was the Winchester's house had the numbers reversed from where we saw him in Home.
Yes, and that's the only one I picked up on.
Okay, so instead of 1481, it was 1841 in Home. The second one was that when Dean's watching the TV in the middle of the night, KJLT timestamp says it's 9 a.m. Central.
Right.
And the newspaper headline about the one-year anniversary of the airplane crash says it's December 5th, 2005, but Dean is seen mowing the lawn.
Right. Which would probably not be.
So, not in December.
Right.
And the lawnmower doesn't have blades. So those are things that Dean would have known.
Right.
He knows how to mow a lawn, even if he probably hasn't done it. I mean, it doesn't, it's a machine.
Right.
It's not something that's really complicated.
That would be a very good question to ask, you know, to say, which one of these did you do on purpose and which of them,
yeah,
or were they all on purpose? Or
yeah, and I like that they were really well hidden. I mean, you had to have really been watching it to catch those.
Right.
And of course, I do now because I podcast and I feel like I need to learn everything.
That's right.
But I also like the ambiguity. I like the fact that they'll do things that let you interpret things different ways. And we haven't had a lot of interpretive opportunities in the last few episodes.
No, they've been very straightforward for the most part. Well, speaking of all the past few episodes, it seemed like they've been very Dean-centric. And not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it makes me wonder, you know, are they trying to prepare from some major Sam storyline in the season finale? Or is it just because they like to give Jensen a lot to do?
You know, a lot of these things that he's been given in the last couple episodes are things that are either have been lacking in his character that we used to see that we haven't seen.
Oh, right.
Or they were things that kind of tied up, like the scene with John at the grave.
Right.
You know, that was something that tied up from the first part of the season. So, it's funny because the show is usually Sam-centered.
Right.
I mean, it really is. He's the hero. He's the main character. He's the chosen one, whatever you want to call him.
Right.
He's the one with the powers. He always seems to be the one that is sort of the center, even though they share the screen time pretty much equal.
Right.
And they're both equal characters. It seems that it's more of Sam's deal.
Right, because we've been brought in, with Sam's point of view, where, he's reluctant to be on this mission and reluctant to have these destinies. And so the audience has always kind of been identifying with Sam.
Yeah.
But the last, several episodes, it's been very much Dean focus. And I thought that was an interesting shift.
Yeah, I think it's probably setting us up for something, but I think in a lot of ways it was Kripke and all the writers and producers' way of tying up some things.
Right.
Because they know how we hate to leave things unsaid.
Right.
I mean, big things, not just some random little thing, but like the big things.
Right. And there was a lot of complaining about Dean's character at the beginning of the season, so they've definitely brought him back into form with his one-liners and wisecracks and all that.
Yep, but it took him a long time, and I think that the scene, even though it was in his head with John's grave, I think that's going to be a really pivotal thing for his character.
Most likely. Which, speaking of in the head, I think that was my big complaint about the episode. Like we said before, we love it. Really enjoyed it, but I have to wonder, I wasn't 100% sure how this wish thing worked. Was it something that a fantasy world that was created to pacify him, or was it based on granting one wish, in the result of how his world would change based on that one wish? I mean, because it seemed like his one wish was, the one he thought it was that his mom didn't die and wasn't killed by, the ceiling demon, and how his life resulted as that. But it just seemed like so many other things could have been, like his girlfriend seemed created out of his head in those situations, so I couldn't tell how the wishing worked exactly.
Yeah, I do like how some of those things were put in because of some subliminal things. Like the girl, like Carmen, she's from a beer ad.
Right.
So it's something he'd seen before and incorporated that in. But that's what dreams are. I mean, you take things from your real life, but then you also incorporate all of these other things that your brain makes up.
Right.
Whether it was a dream or whether it was just an implanted image, it was still kind of had the same result, I think.
Yeah, so it could be a combination. He has one overpowering wish, and then the rest of that world is filled in with details from his subconscious, if that makes any sense at
Yeah.
all.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt one of his wishes or in his head was, I really want to date the girl from the beer
Right,
ad. I mean,
exactly. You just have to wonder then, if you start attributing a subconscious to everything that resulted in that dream world, you have to wonder why some choices were made or why some things turned out the way they did, like his relationship with Sam.
it was sad to see that if that all wouldn't have happened, they would not be friends. I mean, all of this did happen for at least one good result then.
And it seemed like both of them, having grown up caring for other people and saving people's lives, made them better people than they would have been had they grown up without that kind of adversity.
Yeah, I didn't like, I mean, I know it was played out that way because it was, Sam and Dean weren't friends in his vision, dream, wish, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
But, and I know that's probably the way Jared was playing it, but it just seemed really like Sam was very disinterested. You've hurt me too many times. I just want nothing to do with you. It doesn't matter that you're my brother. I don't care. I
Right.
don't want anything to do with you. And that seemed almost a little too over the top.
Well, that's what brought up my whole confusion was, if it was Dean's perfect world, then they would still be close,
And then suddenly, boom, we're best friends and you have to stay here.
Right.
I mean, it was just, probably the djinn saying, oh crap, he's coming out and I want to keep him, let's push him in.
Right.
But it seemed really, really different. Like,
And that which is entirely possible as a result of that they didn't have, if they grew up in this world where they didn't count on each other so much. And Dean, as lovable as we find him in real life, he'd probably be a real jerk to be around.
yeah, like Carmen was even saying, wow, I like you better now.
Right.
So, yeah, it just seemed like he was going to be kind of the wife beater variety.
Right.
Just like this guy who works in a as a mechanic and doesn't have any future and's not a nice guy,
Right.
which just doesn't seem like Dean's true nature anyhow.
Yeah.
Even if he were in a different world.
Which, brings me to another question, which, if this is true, it'll really blow my mind because I think the writers would did such an awesome job. But throughout the whole episode, characters are telling Dean that he should get some rest. So you have to wonder, you know, is that the djinn saying, you know, just quit fighting it and get some rest and stay submissive so I can eat you? Or is that what his real wish was, that he could give up this whole hunting life and just relax and be normal? And even Mary echoes it at the very end, you know, to just get some rest. And that's something that we've seen through this whole season, where he's ready to give up the whole thing because it's cost him too much. It's cost him his dad, and, you know, it might cost him his brother. Several points where he was ready to just throw it all away. And you have to wonder if maybe that's the wish that the djinn was trying to answer, as opposed to bringing his mother back or, you know, changing anything else.
That's really interesting.
But, you know, I could be totally reading too much into it, but that seems to me that, you know, it would seem to tie up the whole arc of Dean this season very nicely. And then so at the end he makes the decision, well, you know, I need to hang on to this life and I need to keep fighting. If the whole thing was in Dean's head, there were several scenes we shouldn't have seen at all. Kind of like, you know, the episode where Tall Tales, where they're all telling things from their point of view, and you're like, well, how would they have seen that? But
yeah,
in this one,
yeah,
where they show scenes with, you know, Sam and Jessica alone in their room, you know, Dean wouldn't have been there to see that, so we shouldn't have been able to see it. And my final nitpick is those pictures of the family. Some of them were so horribly photoshopped that I was embarrassed for the production department.
I actually went and looked at the screen caps that they have at one of my favorite Supernatural sites, is supernatural.tv. It is absolutely hilarious to see those screen caps. I actually, you know, I enlarged them and looked at it, and I'm like, it's horrible. I mean, if my friend was like, it looks like his arm is bending in some unnatural direction.
And it seems like the colors are off and the sizing.
I think what they really did was just take, you know, cut and paste people's heads.
Yeah, they probably did.
And I think a couple of those pictures were actually probably from, like, Jensen's prom. Like,
yes, I think so. Some of them were, like, their actual childhood photos, which was interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if they got that whoever that girl is to say, sure, you can use my picture.
Right. I'm on TV!
Maybe it was another way of Dean's mind telling him it wasn't real.
Yeah, yeah, that's what we can say.
There we go.
Crazy big-headed John photoshopped on here. Something's not right.
It was like he was trying to piece together memories he didn't have.
Oh, right.
And so it didn't look right.
That's right.
I'm sticking with that.
Totally on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, we did have a couple revelations. John was destined to die anyway.
Or maybe Dean is okay with him being dead, at least.
Or maybe it was just too much for his brain to handle,
right,
all at once. Like mom and dad back.
Right.
Dean would rather have this imperfect life hunting with Sam, even though they've lost a lot, they've made huge sacrifices, but they have made a difference to a lot of people in a lot of ways.
That's right.
But I think the most important is that Sam and Dean wouldn't have a relationship if it weren't for this.
That's right. The difference that they have made together, you know, not they're with their relationship and with their closeness and their fighting, is something worth continuing instead of just giving up for the peace of mind that he's always been craving. And it was neat, you know, revealed another type of legend in the Supernatural canon with the nature of genies or the djinn.
Yeah, I liked that. I hadn't expected that we would get, you know, more legends by the end of the season.
Right.
As they'd been kind of anti-legend, vengeful ghost pro lately.
Right.
So I didn't think we'd get as much content as we did in this one. And, you know, my favorite quote was probably, you know, Dean's while he was talking to John's tombstone. You know, why is it my job to save these people? Why do I have to be the kind of hero? You know, mom's not supposed to live her life. Sammy's not supposed to get married. Why do we have to sacrifice everything? And he doesn't have an answer. He just knows.
Exactly. And that's the big question that he's been struggling with all season.
Rewarding.
That was. It was good to tie that up. Like you said, finally get that chance to mourn. See, my favorite quote was during that, you know, reenactment of the first episode with Dean wrestling with Sam. And he says, that was so easy, I'm embarrassed for you.
Why does everybody think I'm drunk?
Right.
Or why does everybody think I've been drinking? Because everybody asked him.
Right.
His mom and Sam and the professor, they were like, son, have you been drinking?
He's drunk dialing. I guess he's probably a big drinker in that reality. And even in the restaurant where he asked how he ended up with such a cool chick, and she says, I have low standards. And you wonder, So in this perfect world, he's kind of a loser.
They're just getting better.
That's right. I think, the last set has been really well done. I think we had a lot of weirdness, especially after the first two episodes of this season, where you're like, what's going on? And Sam constantly whining about his destiny, but things have really picked up lately.
Let's move on to legends and references. Legends. First and foremost, we had jinns. In Islamic mythology, the jinn are fiery spirits, one of which was Iblis, from the Arabic junna, which is angry, possessed. The jinn pre-existed in Middle Eastern folklore before Islam and were incorporated into the religion. The jinn are creatures who lived on earth before man. They were made up of smokeless fire, whereas men were made of earth. Jinn are often disruptive, but can sometimes be of service to mankind. The jinn shunned daylight and were responsible for disease and insanity. Unlike other devilish creatures, however, the jinn are creatures of free will, even having a chance at redemption through Islam. The three classes of jinn are 1. Ghoul, which is mischievous, shape-shifting spirits associated with graveyards. Ghoul, spelled G-H-U-L, is the origin of the English word ghoul. 2. Sila, a jinn who can appear in any form. And 3. Ifrit, which are evil spirits. In Middle Eastern magical practice, jinn are invoked much like the spirits of the goetia in Western magic. The word genie is a corruption of jinn. Both jinn and genius probably share a common root. Jinn are said to avoid salt and steel and to be afraid of the sound of singing. The word jinn literally means anything that has a connotation or concealment, invisibility, seclusion, and remoteness. In English, it is sometimes mistakenly translated as ghost. For the ancient Semites, jinn were spirits of vanished ancient peoples who acted during the night and disappeared with the first light of dawn. They can make themselves invisible or change shape into animals at will. These spirits were commonly believed to be responsible for diseases and for the manias of some lunatics. Arabs believed that the jinn were spirits of fire, although sometimes they associated them with succubi, demons in the forms of beautiful women. The feminine form of jinn is jinnia or jinnia. Jinns can possess people by entering their body. These possessed people need to be seen by a malvi in Urdu, an Islamic scholar. The scholars read Arabic chants and blow on the person affected. There were several references in this episode. The movie on Dean's TV when he wakes up is From Hell It Came from 1957. Dean's comments that Barbara Eden was way hotter than that bewitched chick. Barbara Eden played a genie, or djinn, in the 1960s TV series I Dream of Jeannie. Elizabeth Montgomery starred as Samantha, a witch with a twitchy nose in the TV series Bewitched. Personally, I prefer Bewitched. The scene of Dean mowing the lawn behind a picket fence is a visual reference to the David Lynch movie Blue Velvet, which is about the darkness that can lie beneath an idyllic suburban facade. And there were two quotes in the movie The Wizard of Oz. One, where Dean says, "We're not in Kansas anymore." And then another when Dean wakes up, saying, "Auntie M, there's no place like home." This is the same line Dorothy says when she wakes up back in Kansas. There was some really great music in this episode. They played What a Wonderful World by the Ramones and Saturday Night Special by Lynyrd Skynyrd. The song of the night tonight is Who I Am Hates Who I've Been by one of my favorite bands, Reliant K, brought to you by Punko's Acoustic 2 from the Pod Show PodSafe Music Network. Enjoy!
The proverbial sunrise coming up over the Pacific, and you might think I'm losing my mind, but I will shy away from the specifics, 'cause I don't want you to know where I am, 'cause then you'll see my heart in the saddest state it's ever been, and this is no place to try and live my life. Stop right there, that's exactly where I lost it. I see that line, I never should have crossed it. Stop right there, I never should have said that. It's the very moment that I wish that I could take back. I'm sorry for the person I became. I'm sorry that it took so long for me to change. I'm ready to be sure I never become that way again. 'Cause who I am hates who I've been. Who I am hates who I've been. talk to absolutely no one. Couldn't keep to myself enough, and the things bottled inside have finally begun to create so much pressure that I'd soon blow up. And I heard the reverberating footsteps sinking up to the beating of my heart. And I was positive that unless I got myself together, I would watch me fall apart. And I can't let that happen again, 'cause then you'll see my heart in the saddest state it's ever been. And this is no place to try.
And I have a couple articles for you this time. Supernatural, What Is and What Should Never Be, by Brett Love for TV Squad, posted on May 4th, 2007. I'm only going to read an excerpt from this article. It's been a strange week of coincidences on television. Bones and CSI both did Alien episodes, while Heroes and Supernatural both featured What If stories. Having now watched all four of those, What Is and What Should Never Be was my favorite of the bunch. Credit the lion's share of that accomplishment to the ever-improving Jensen Ackles. That final battle with the djinn was pretty good, if a little quick. That's understandable, though, because the meat of the story was in the look at what could have been. It was a well-crafted story that did a good job of balancing some fun stuff with the heavier issue of just what the Winchester lot in life really is. We had the Dean was so excited about things just being normal that he couldn't wait to mow the lawn. And there was, once again, the Dean who loves to eat. That all contrasted nicely with the Dean that was worried about the ghosts he was seeing. The same Dean that started looking up past hunts to see the effect that his newfound happiness was having on others. The recreated scene from the pilot where Dean sneaks into Sam Majeska's place was another nice detail. My favorite part of the episode, though, was the conversation that Dean had with the departed John. In the fantasy world where Mary never died, John is still a huge influence on his boys. It was a great scene to watch, performed fantastically by Ackles. It was a reflective moment that was much more about coming to terms with the answer that he already knew, rather than asking the question. That just narrowly beat out the heart-to-heart Sam and Dean shared after it was all over. Overall, this was an outstanding episode. It was the perfect way to end the regular season. The playoffs start next week as Team Supernatural kicks off its big two-part season finale. That should answer some of those questions we have been pondering all season about Sam, the demon, and the coming battle. We'll head into that adventure full steam ahead as this one gets a 7 out of 7. And the second one I want to share is called Jensen Ackles Shines in a Moving Episode of Supernatural by Ed Martin from MediaVillage.com, May 1st, 2007. These two links will be in the show notes. Supernatural is on a late season roll. 2 weeks ago, the CW's Thursday Night Horror Show presented an episode titled Hollywood that many fans feel may have been its best episode ever. This week's chiller, entitled What Is and What Should Never Be, is another winner, and it features what may be the best performance ever by series lead Jensen Ackles as Dean Winchester, one of the two demon-hunting brothers around whom the show revolves. Filled with inside jokes and internal industry references, Hollywood followed Dean and his brother Sam, Jared Padalecki, during a vacation in Los Angeles, where they improbably became production assistants on a horror movie called Hellraisers 2: The Reckoning that appeared cursed with a haunted set. It was revealed that the on-set scares plaguing the production were part of a marketing stunt designed to generate all-important internet buzz. I'm the new lonely girl, one of the actors involved in the dupe quip. But the boys eventually discovered that real spirits were up to no good. Maybe the spirits are trying to shut down the movie because they think it sucks, Sam suggests, commenting, one might conclude, on the state of most contemporary horror films, which don't offer half the scares or character development of the average Supernatural episode. What If takes our heroes out of their reality, if the world they inhabit in the series can be referred to as real, into the mind of Dean, where he experiences a largely idyllic existence for himself and Sam that he can only wish for amid the horrors of their everyday ordeals. It's the work of a djinn, or genie, that takes people captive and creates a dream world in which their fantasies come true, until the djinn kills them.
In Dean's world, his mother and Sam's girlfriend Jessica, both killed by a demon, as you saw way back in the Supernatural pilot, are alive and well, and Dean has a hot girlfriend. You'll have to tune in to learn the dream world fate of the boy's late father, John, played by fan favorite Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Like Hollywood, not to mention many of the best episodes of the classic supernatural thriller The X-Files, there's much humor in What If. In a running gag, everyone the happily disoriented Dean meets in his dream, including Sam, his late mother Mary, and a helpful professor, all conclude that he has been drinking. Dean also takes extreme delight in eating, a disarming trait of his throughout the season, but never more so than his mother's house in this episode and at the craft services tables in Hollywood. It's touching to watch as Dean realizes that in this reality, his beloved mother is still alive. He can't stop hugging her. And it's interesting to see him united with Dreamworld Sam, who lives far away in California with Jessica, played once again by Friday Night Lights sensation Adrian Palicki. As was true in the Supernatural pilot, before the boys were plunged into a life of drifting and demon hunting, Sam and Dean aren't close. "What's with the warm and fuzzy stuff?" Sam asks Dean. "We only talk at holidays." It seems Sam is still pissed at Dean for sleeping with Sam's prom date on prom night. What If takes an abrupt turn into powerful emotional reality once Dean figures out what's going on with his newfound happiness is shattered by the grim realization that the many losses his family has suffered in the real world are important and necessary. "Why do we have to sacrifice everything?" Dean sobs at the grave of a loved one. He's crying for his family's sacrifices, for lost happiness, and because for the first time he truly understands the overall importance of what the Winchester men do. The emotions Dean is feeling in the scene surface once again at the end of the episode. Who knew Ackles was such a strong actor? Perhaps he never had that kind of material he's been getting lately as Supernatural builds momentum towards its big second season finale. I assume the CW will bring this show back next year and keep it paired with Smallville. These two shows together make a fine alternative to the formidable fare on CBS, NBC, and especially ABC on Thursday night. Supernatural takes a beating opposite CBS's CSI and ABC's Grey's Anatomy, but its fans find it anyway, and is surely a DVR and DVD favorite. It's also another fine escapist viewing during the hot summer months for those who have been distracted by other Thursday night fare during the season. I thought those were really great articles, and I wanted to share them with you. But that's it for this episode. We'll be back next week with our review of the two-part season finale, All Hell Breaks Loose. Thanks for listening, and take care. Thank you for listening to the Supernatural Podcast. You can visit my website at supernaturalpodcast.blogspot.com or send me an email at supernaturalpodcast@gmail.com. Please note that the opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and not of the producers of Supernatural or the CW. Audio clips played on this podcast are property of the CW and no infringement is intended. Some of the music heard here is from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.